Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Jonathan Watkins. We are talking about Firestarter 2 Rekindled today. Jonathan, I have to let you know right away that I totally thought this was a TV movie and not a TV miniseries. So when I saw the runtime, I was a little confused.
It's all good. Hello, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. And I want to apologize to you again, because I feel like you always happen to pick some of the ones where it's kind of like, okay, we know this is going to not be great, but we're going to talk about it anyway. And they tend to be shorter episodes. But I think with this one, there is a little more to talk about than some of the others we have talked about before, not only because of it running nearly 3 hours, but just the fact that they did some things that I thought were choices that made sense, but I still didn't like them. Like, for instance, well, let's talk about the cast first, because I feel like this actually had a fairly well-known cast for the time. You had Malcolm McDowell, Danny Nucci. I'm totally spacing on the lady's name who plays Charlie McGee, because
I don't actually know how to, it's like Margie, is it Margit? It's her name is hard to pronounce. She's the one from Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah, her name is Marguerite Moreau, I want to say.
Yeah, hopefully that's right.
We will go with that. And like you said, hope it's right. And then you also have Dennis Hopper, who makes an appearance later in the miniseries.
Yeah, very random Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I was like, okay, you know, maybe this will be better than I'm expecting because of the cast. But then it felt so almost soap opera-like in some instances. And I was just like, what is this vibe that they're going for? Because Marguerite is playing a grown-up Charlie McGee and she's going by a different name. But the cast just felt like they were overacting a lot of the time. And I was like, this is a very strange thing that they have going on. And I think Malcolm McDowell was very Malcolm McDowell in this, to say the least. He definitely played the creepy guy well. But the other downside is that he was another white guy playing John Rainbird.
Oh, yeah. See, it's so, because it's been a long time. I have read this book, but it's been a long time. So the character, and it's been a long time since I've seen the first movie, but I remember in the first movie, it's George C. Scott.
Right.
I believe plays him. So in the book, he's...
he's Native American.
Yeah, that is weird. I assume this movie, though, was just doing it because they wanted it to be, I guess, based off, because this is a sequel to the movie.
Right.
But yeah, I was a little confused by a lot of things with him, because I thought I remembered he was more just like a hired gun, almost, at least in the book, isn't he? Like, it felt like he was more involved with everything than he really was originally, but I could be wrong about that.
In the book, it's the shop who is going after Charlie, and they've basically hired John Rainbird to work on this particular program, which is the Lot 6 program.
Okay.
And so that carries over, but he definitely is hired by the shop, but he's very sort of anti-authority. He doesn't like being told what to do, from what I can remember from both the book and the movie with Drew Barrymore. And when you have someone trying to follow up Drew Barrymore's performance as Charlie, even though she was so young, it was right around the time of when she appeared in E.T., and she was just this child star, and then you have someone else coming in and playing the character as, you know, a 20-something Charlie McGee, and the feeling you get from Charlie in the original movie does not carry over to the Charlie we see in this TV miniseries. And overall, it just felt like the whole thing was off. Like, it didn't really seem like this is the person Charlie McGee would grow up to be.
Yeah, and you almost wonder if they could have just, like, would it have mattered if they had just made it, like, another Lot 6 person? Or another kid that had been born from, did it have to be her? You know, like, I don't know that that would have mattered. Like, Marguerite Moreau could have just played, like, another character that had similar abilities. And I think that would have worked just as well. The Malcolm McDowell thing seemed a little odd, too, just because I just kept picturing George C. Scott, and
yeah,
And then they even do that thing where they do the flashbacks to Charlie when she's younger. And of course, they don't have the actors. They're not like using the footage from the original film, and they don't have the actors because obviously the actors are older and whatnot. But they still tried to make them look like them. So that's always weird to me. Like they tried to do like the, is it Keith? It's not Keith David that plays them. I can't remember. Whoever plays the dad in the original, like he had that like 80s kind of permish hair. You know, and like they give that to the guy in this one when they show the flashbacks. I just always find stuff like that very odd.
Absolutely. But the girl who was playing the young Charlie McGee was actually in Storm of the Century. So
interesting.
She had already been in a Stephen King property. And unfortunately, she has since passed on. She died in her early 20s, if I'm not mistaken.
Was Storm of the Century, was it like, it was late 90s, right?
It was 99. Right before the,
okay, yeah, so it was about 3 years before, because this was 2002.
Yeah.
And I have seen Storm of the Century, but it's been a very, very long time, but that's cool.
Yeah, so that was just a fun little connection to make real quick with, you know, all of these adaptations, because so many people come back. You have Gary Sinise, who appears in more than one adaptation, David Morse, just so many, especially big names, sort of repeat. We can't not mention Kathy Bates. You know, she's both in Misery and Dolores Claiborne, and fantastic in both of them. So even within the acting community, there are people who really seem to be drawn towards Stephen King adaptations. And obviously this is not the best example of one because it was a child actress who, unfortunately, like I said, not with us still, but you just get a sense that there's something about it that makes people want to keep doing them. Even if the idea might not seem the best, or there's plot holes or things like that. And while I don't think there's a ton of plot holes in this necessarily, I just think, as well as it being a little weird to see a grown-up Charlie McGee, this story just doesn't really have a ton going for it, because the whole thing is basically a redo of the program. And you get this sense immediately that, okay, well, obviously Charlie's going to have to stick around and try and stop them because John Rainbird's back, and it's predictable.
Yeah, I am. I couldn't find anything specific to this, but I had a theory. I don't even know, because it seems very obvious that, you know, the X-Men movie came out 2 years prior to this. And was, you know, a massive hit. A lot of people, you know, a lot of people use that as the example of what started, you know, the comic book movie trend as far as, you know, how they are presented now. And this was just 2 years later. So you kind of had a feeling like sci-fi was like, you know, what IP can I get a hold of and kind of make it X-Men-esque? Because it's, especially with the kids that were, what is it? It's called The Town instead of The Shop, right? Isn't that what they call it in this one?
Yeah, because basically they've replicated an entire town.
Yes, which I had so many questions about that.
Yeah, the idea is that they're using it for testing, but it's so deserted every time they go there. You're like, well, when are they doing the testing? Have they already done the testing before the movie even begins? And all of the kids are fairly young, so you're kind of like, okay, what is going on?
Yeah, why wouldn't you just take them to a random town and, you know, let them do their thing? But the fact that you had all those kids with different abilities, you know, that's where it kind of, it felt very X-Men to me.
Yes.
And Malcolm McDowell is almost like kind of, not Magneto, but he kind of has that feel to him, like, right? Like he's like, you know, like an evil
mastermind,
Professor Xavier, maybe.
Yeah. And then you have the kid who has the Black Canary like powers, where you get like the sonic waves that just kind of crush everything in its path and throw people across the room. And it almost felt like they wanted this to be a superhero mini series.
I think they did. I mean, what I was trying to figure out is if they had it, because a lot of the times these miniseries you find out were planned to be a TV show or had that potential if it did well. And I don't know how well this did, but I mean, it's definitely not something people talk about today, but I couldn't find anything on that. But I'm really curious, like if this had done really well, like would they have turned this into like a, you know, an X-Men style like TV series where you've got like maybe Charlie's like leading up these kids and you know, they're finding like the John Rainbirds of the world and trying to stop them. I don't know. That's kind of how it felt like where it was going to me, you know, but I couldn't find anything to confirm or deny that.
Yeah. And the thing is, this is pretty hard to find unless you want to buy the DVD of it. It's not streaming anywhere. You can't rent it. You can't buy it digitally. And it is always interesting to me which Stephen King adaptations this happens with, because I feel like there's just something about certain ones, whether it's the production companies or rights or what have you, where you just cannot find them very easily. And to be honest, I wasn't too thrilled that with some of these, I would either have to resort to finding them different ways or, you know, like Rose Red, for instance, the DVD was $50. And I was like, I don't want to pay $50 to watch this. And
oh, and a lot of them aren't very good. Like this one, I just randomly had this. I was telling you, I don't even know. I must have just, I don't know if somebody just gave it to me because they're like, hey, you like Stephen King, or if I just picked it up like in a you know, a grouping of other movies or something, but I just randomly had it. And it's a terrible transfer. I mean, I don't know how great it looked on TV in 2002, but it's a really, really bad DVD transfer. But you would think, I mean, with Stephen King's name alone, even though this isn't a direct adaptation, if they released like a $10 or $15 Blu-ray of this, I mean, they would sell, you know, they would sell some because collectors would, you know, be like, I've got to have this. So it is really weird when you can't find something with his name attached to it. He could have buried it too, though. I mean, he very well could have had something to do with it not being available. Because he's definitely tried to do that in the past with some stuff that, you know, was not really a direct adaptation of his material, but wanted to put his name on it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think the biggest example of that that I can recall is the Lawnmower Man movies, because that first
where he
one...
wanted his name taken off.
Yeah, that first one that came out had his name on it, but it had absolutely nothing to do with the short story. And
nope.
I found this guy who had done a short of the Lawnmower Man, and I talked to him about his short for this podcast because it was like this college project that he did, but it was on YouTube. So I was like, you know what? This is true to the story. So I'm going to watch this on YouTube, even though the quality was not good at all. Because
is it still there though? Because I want to see a man eating grass. It's like that image from that. I don't even know if I like that story very much, but that image has stuck with me my whole, because I probably read that when I was in like high school and or right before the movie came out. And that image of like the naked guy eating the grass is just always like stuck with me for some reason. King has that ability to do that to you.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find that and send it to you, because
thank you.
It's definitely a fun little watch. It's only like 7 or 10 minutes or something. It's definitely a short in the shortest sense, you know.
But the story's only like 10 pages, right? So, yeah. I mean, that actually makes sense, you know. Was that one of the dollar babies, I guess? Did he get permission to do it or?
Yeah, because he was doing it for a school project. It was like,
oh, that's cool.
Something he did. And I think one of the guys who worked on it ended up working at New Line Cinema or something like that. So, you know, something definitely came of it at least. But with Firestarter 2, I was like, okay, you get these big names and you have this story that should in theory work, but there's something about it. It just felt like it was too long. It was too soap opera like in too many places.
It's definitely too long. That is 100% probably the biggest problem with this movie. There are actually really cool moments in this movie. Like I love when it takes like 2 hours, but when she finally gets to the facility, there's like some pretty, there's really, really bad special effects, but there's some pretty cool moments in that. Like when she first confronts the kids, and because they've heard, because I guess we should like, Malcolm McDowell has been telling the John Rainbird has been telling these kids stories about her for however long. So when they finally get to meet her, you know, they're just like, well, you're not all that. And then she shows them that she actually is. So that's kind of a fun moment. I also liked the twist with the Dennis Hopper character where, he thought he was helping her, but, he really wasn't, because, you know, it was always, I guess, you know, preordained that he would bring her there, or however you want to put that. I thought that was interesting, but there wasn't enough of that to keep me invested for 2 hours and 48 minutes or whatever it was.
It was definitely long, and I think 2 hours and 48 is the runtime on it, and you have to imagine that with commercials on TV, that mm-hmm. would have felt even longer, because I've noticed that with these, you can obviously tell where the commercial breaks are, but you mm-hmm. can also kind of tell where they just ended and picked it back up the next night or next week or whatever. I think most of them aired, you know, X amount of nights in a row for the most part. But
yeah,
you have this thing with TV miniseries where you have to have something dramatic happen at the end of each episode. Mm-hmm. But you don't get that same feeling when you watch it straight through, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Yeah, you definitely don't. Like, you don't get that, like, that you like, yeah, like the first night cliffhanger. Because I'm assuming this, I think this was a two-part miniseries, because if it was almost 3 hours, that probably means with commercials it was like four. And we should also say, because when you say sci-fi original, like a lot of the times people, I think, immediately just think of like Sharknado. This was actually when sci-fi was kind of trying to do something, you know, decent with these miniseries and these TV movies. They weren't just trying to be so bad they're good, or, you know, throwing, you know, crazy monsters into the mix. So this definitely has a little more going for it than your run of the mill, I would say, you know, made for sci-fi TV movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was just one of those things where I was watching it and I was like, oh, no, here we go.
It doesn't look good. Like, I kind of joked about the special effects, but I mean, they're really bad. Like, even I feel like for this time period, because if you think about like TV shows and stuff that were on during this time period, you know, and this, you know, this movie had probably a decent amount of money behind it. So, but this was just like that early 2000s computer graphic stuff. So all the fire stuff just looks so bad. I don't even know how to explain it.
It almost didn't even look like fire at times. They were just like orange.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you would think, like, if you think back to the original movie, you know, they just used fire. So, you know, they just had stuntmen and women that were on fire. This is 100%, as far as I remember, it was 100% CG. I don't think they'd had any real fire stunts in this one. Even like when she's like setting things on fire that aren't people, like when she was setting like that one, you know, kind of sex scene where she's about to have sex with Danny Nucci, and, you know, the pieces of the pages of the documents are igniting. Even that was CG. Like, they didn't just, you know, set a piece of paper on fire, which would have probably been better, but oh well.
Yeah. I think what they tried to do was replicate how big the movie went.
Mm-hmm.
And because they wanted to do that, but they got these bigger cast members, they probably didn't have the same kind of budget. And it's hard to think that CGI would have been less expensive at the time than actually just blowing things up. But I don't know anything about blowing things up in movies and all of the precautions you have to take. I imagine it's a lot, and you have to hire the right people who know what to do. And, you know, obviously demolitions experts and whatnot. But I think that was something that benefited the movie, especially given the time period. They knew that if they didn't do real explosions, it wasn't going to look great, because you do have those moments in the original movie where Charlie does like send the bolts of fire or the balls of fire, and that doesn't look super great, because kind of make that happen in real life. But here it somehow looked worse when she was doing that, because it was kind of like she would start glowing, and then the hair with the fan, and it was just so much. And you could tell they really, really wanted to go for the, oh, Charlie McGee is this hot girl now.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I said, it's been a long time since I've seen the movie. Like, I'm guessing it's been 20 years. I don't remember it being like exceptional by any means. So, I mean, I mean, maybe they didn't really have a whole lot to continue. I do recall really liking the book, though. And I know that's one of his books that doesn't really, I don't think it's talked about that much. And probably kind of understandably so, because I think it came out like right after like Shining and Stand and stuff like that. So it's kind of an odd, it's kind of an odd place for the book to be. But I remember the book actually being really cool. And I really enjoyed like the stuff with the shop and everything. But then I just remember the movie being a little disappointing. But I'm assuming it's way better than this. But like I said, it's been so long.
I think the reason the movie works is because they were able to take this young character, which Stephen King likes to write children with powers. Mm-hmm. That's not a surprise to anyone who's been following his work at this point. But when they take source material, decide to age up the character and kind of change everything about the story, and they don't even mention the shop in here. It's just like some random company that has no apparent connection to the shop. And I think it would have been more fun if they had played into the shop a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I kind of got the impression that the shop was just defunct, like, you know, whatever, like they got found out and people were thought to have been killed. So they just kind of, they basically like changed the name to the town or whatever, just to make it more so people weren't comparing it. But they don't explain that. I mean, if that's the case, they don't really explain that. But that was just kind of what I took from it. But I agree with you 100%. I don't know why. Yeah. And that town made no sense to me. Like this, the whole, cause I mean, there were real people living there, right? And like working like at the bank and the ice cream shop and whatever. And I was like, do they know what's going on? Like, but then at the end, based on what they were planning on doing as an experiment, I guess they didn't. But the whole thing with the town just really confused me. And I didn't think the movie did a very good job of explaining it well enough for me to understand it better than I did.
Yeah, I looked up the shop real quick here on the Stephen King wiki page, and it does say they make an appearance in this, but like you said, it's never explained. And they're also in The Mist, they're in The Tommyknockers, they're mentioned in The Stand. So there's a running theme with the shop in multiple Stephen King novels. And
yeah.
Obviously, given the time frame, by the time this happened, it is possible that they were defunct or they were just going by that new company name. But it felt like that was never really clear. The only connection was John Rainbird. And it's like, well, he could have just manipulated some other place into letting him do these experiments.
And then, like I said, yeah, once again, like that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me either, why they would leave him in charge, because he was clearly not of sound mind at all. And I mean, they could have had any kind of, actual physician in there helping these kids. They didn't need him. And then George C. Scott, of course, had passed away, so you couldn't cast him anyways. But then, like you're saying, why didn't they just go ahead and make him Native American at that point? Might as well.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that either. So the whole thing just seemed kind of silly with Malcolm McDowell. As much as I love Malcolm McDowell, and I'm never going to be upset he's in a movie, but that character just didn't. It didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. You mentioned that about the shop being in other novels. And see, that's the one thing I really need to actually kind of read these things in order better, because that's the cool thing you're getting to experience with King. And then I know he has that new a couple years ago, The Institute, which I have not read.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Is it adjacent to, do you know, is it or is it not?
It has nothing to do with the shop from what I could tell. Oh, okay. I did read that one out of order because I received a copy of it from the publicist. And so I read it and it felt a lot like Firestarter in a lot of ways. It was just a little different because I don't want to give anything away for anyone who hasn't read it, but there were multiple kids who were sort of the center of attention in the story versus just one.
Oh, so kind of more like this movie.
Yes and no, because a lot of, I think, the Institute comes from like the kid's perspective.
Yeah, that makes sense. I see what you're saying. Yeah, and it definitely isn't the case in this. I mean, it's all Rainbird and Charlie. And then, I mean, in Danny Nucci, and then Danny Nucci's character, I did kind of find that interesting that, you know, they were doing the whole, like, I guess he was, I don't know what his actual job title was, but he worked for the firm that was looking for these people. They were his. He was told that everyone was involved in a class action lawsuit.
Yeah.
And he was finding them so they could collect their money. And then he found out that ended up just being a front, and, you know, they were really trying to kill them and stuff. Although I did find it odd that nothing, his life had never been threatened until he found Charlie, because he had already found a bunch of these people.
Right.
And had probably used, like, he had used, like, people to help him, like his brother or whatever, because that becomes a plot point. So that didn't really make any sense to me either.
And Charlie was the only one they didn't want dead necessarily, or at least Rainbird didn't want her dead.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah. Yeah. And, but yeah, which I don't know. So yeah, like I don't know. I feel like there wasn't a lot of thought put into some of this, but you know, that's fine. I mean, it's not the end. It's not that big of a deal, but it confused me, you know, like things like that just kind of confused me. And then the movie doesn't really explain a lot of it. So, you know.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I was really hoping I would go into it and end up liking it more than I expected. Mm-hmm. But when you have things like this, the problem is that Stephen King, even at this time, was such a popular name, even, you know, a couple decades before this one, mm-hmm. that people just wanted to take some of these stories that he had written and run with them in different directions. And while I am all for adaptations not being exactly like the source material, you know, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining is obviously the biggest and possibly best example of this. But even when you have things like comic book movies, I don't need it to be a one-to-one adaptation. I just need it to make sense for what you're going for with the movie. And I felt like this should have made more sense.
Well, and like I said, I can't, you know, I don't have anything backing this up, but it's just, it's so close to the X-Men release and how popular X-Men was and how popular comic book movies were becoming.
Yeah.
And you said this felt more like a comic book movie at times, like a superhero movie. And I just feel like they had an IP that was cheap and they could kind of rework it to, you know, maybe appeal to that type of demographic or that type of, you know, that fan base. Because those kids just, I mean, they straight up felt like the X-Men. And more so the New Mutants, I guess you would say, or something like that. Just
yeah.
Because of they're in the hospital and everything. I'm not even opposed to that. Like, I mean, that's fine. But like it didn't feel very much like the source material. This felt more like the Lawnmower Man movie versus the Lawnmower Man story. They had characters in here that had the same names, but they definitely didn't feel like the same people. That you were already aware of in the previous movie or the book, if you've read it.
Yeah, I don't want to be totally negative about this. So I will say that one of the things I really liked that they did with Charlie was make it so that she was extremely dedicated to sort of figuring out everything mm-hmm. that happened with Lot 6. She was working at a library. She had access to these files that were once classified. And she was really going all out on finding out what happened with her parents and kind of why she is the way she is, if there's a way to sort of suppress it and things like that, because Lot 6 is something where we know it happened. It's not explained in a ton of detail. It's sort of just like, hey, this government thing decided to do this experiment and then here's what happened. And you get a little more of that in this as they're trying to track people down from the experiments, and you get a glimpse at a couple other people and what they're capable of, especially Dennis Hopper's character. You know, he can see into the future and he knows everything that's going to happen. And even though Charlie manages to change that, it still ends up with the same outcome, basically. And you get her in this town that had been replicated for the experiment.
Yeah.
And you kind of just feel so cheated by Dennis Hopper's character, whose name I can't even remember, but
oh, what is it? It's like Kevin or something. No, that's not right. It's James Richardson.
Okay. And he's one who's kind of been flying under the radar because you see that he's one that they haven't been able to find. They find Charlie McGee basically before they find him, but not really, because then you get this flashback and you're just like, oh my goodness, there is so much going on here.
Yeah.
It's kind of like they were retconning stuff in the midst of the miniseries.
Oh, absolutely. No, it definitely felt like that. And Dennis Hopper, I mean, James Richardson, he's old enough to where I'm assuming we're supposed to think he was in the original experiments.
Yeah.
Like he was there with Charlie's parents. And then, like you said, he was able to escape. Even though and that's the thing. Like I said, I liked that idea that like he was always supposed to bring her there, you know. But that's still putting a lot to chance. And if they were really trying to find these Lot 6 people, and they always knew where he was, or at least Rainbird did, like why would he still be alive? Like that didn't really make any sense. But I agree with you. I don't think this is terrible. I think it's very mediocre at best when it works.
I still didn't like it, but there were certain things that I thought were heading in the right direction, and the outcome just didn't fully get you there. You weren't fully invested in this. Like, I did not care once they got to the town and there was going to be this big showdown. And a lot of these kids, there were, I want to say, one or two who were recognizable. One was played by Dan Bird, and I think he was the older of the boys, and he's just been in a ton of different things here and there.
Yeah, well, and especially like shortly after that, he was on Cougar Town, and I mean, he was in that movie with Emma Stone, Easy A. He's been in a ton of TV shows.
Right, and it looks like he appears in the 2004 Salem's Lot as well.
Oh, that's right, with Rob Lowe. Yeah, that's right. He is in that.
So I have that to look forward to. But for the most part, you have all of these surrounding characters who kind of just come in, they do their scenes, they go out. You have Mary, who is one of the victims, so to speak, and you get a lot with her, but at the same time, they kind of just try to make her look like a crazy lady the entire time. So they don't really give her the proper care to have the audience get more invested in her character. Instead, she's just, you know, kind of rambling the entire time. And you do feel bad for her, but you're not super invested in her story like you tend to be with Charlie.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, you're dead on about that character. That character was there for the most basic of reasons. But like you said, I definitely didn't like it. I would almost like do like a slight, like it's interesting enough to where I would do like a slight recommend to people that just want to watch all the King stuff, even though this is not based on, I mean, Stephen King didn't write anything about this story, but it's just a sequel. But it's just the length. I mean, it's you know, I have a hard time. Like, if it was 90 minutes, I'd probably be like, yeah, check it out, you know?
Yeah, same.
But because it's definitely better than, like, say, those couple of, like, Sometimes They Come Back sequels that I was on for. I mean, I think it's probably, it's definitely just a better quality movie than those.
Yeah.
But I would almost rather watch those just because at least they're only, like, 80 minutes.
And those can be a ridiculous and fun time if you let them. But this is just too long.
Boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's long, and it's just and it's not like so crazy it's funny or anything. It's just pretty bland, I guess, overall. There's, like I said, there's good moments, but but I was with you too on that ending. Like I knew, like I had, especially considering I had already had like 2 hours and 20 minutes of terrible special effects. Like terrible fights.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was nothing that made me interested in like a battle with everybody at the end, because I knew it wasn't going to look good, even if it was done in an interesting way. It's always interesting to me though, to watch these kind of off the radar ones though, because I'm just always curious about, like, you know, what was the reasoning behind even doing it? And I'm sure most of it just has to do with it's Stephen King, and you know, we can attach his name to it and make a few more dollars than we would otherwise. But I mean, like I said, this could have just been called like Fire Mutants or something like that. And it would have been the exact same movie.
Pretty much. And
yeah,
I didn't even bring myself to give this a rating after I finished it. Cause well, one, I was recording a podcast right after I finished watching it. And then I still haven't gone back and rated it because I was like, I don't know how I feel about it other than I didn't really like it.
I haven't either. I would think it's probably like, I mean, you're talking about Letterboxd. I mean, it's a two. Like it feels like a 2-star. Like it's just, you know, it's like a C-, D+. It's in that area for me.
Yeah, I might end up going more in the 1.5 star range, but
I cannot argue with that. I do not blame you. I quit. This is so dorky, but like, I quit doing half stars.
I tried to do that too.
But the reasoning, but this is only for me because it's not like anybody cares. But like, I was always like, what is a 4? Like, it was the 4.5 that was getting me. Like, what is a 4.5 star movie? Like, why is it not a 5? You know, that just started bugging me for some reason. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to take the half stars away. And you can read into my rating however you would like. That means some movies that probably deserve like a 3 or 3.5 get a 4, but oh well.
Yeah, it's just one of those things you have to play with, and everyone's ratings are their own and they have different qualifications for them. But Jonathan, I think that wraps up today's episode. Thank you for coming on to talk about Firestarter 2 Rekindled.
It is always a blast to talk about these weird Stephen King adaptations. It is.
And there's a lot of them.
Yes.
All right. That does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.